Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Nature Now program. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Dr. Chris Kelly, an oceanographer of the deep sea. So welcome, Chris. It's going to be fun talking to you. A little bit of background about Chris. He's worked on deep water fisheries, biological communities that live in the very deep sea, on seamounts and manganese crusts and deep sea things. And of course, that means a little bit about biology and a little bit of geology thrown in there. And I also understand you have an interest in historic shipwrecks. And then his core responsibilities are described as identifying deep water animals that are recorded during submersible and ROV, that's remote operated vehicle operations, extracting and archiving data from deep water dives, and creating online deep water animal identification guides. And Chris, do you have any idea how much time you've spent in a submersible or a down underwater looking at things?
Well, I never counted the number of submersible dives I did, but I know one year, 2002, I believe, I did 20 dives that year alone.
Wow.
So probably close to 100 maybe in a submersible or more. And I also used to do all the test dives for our laboratory.
Pretty amazing.
And of course, remote vehicle dives are a lot of those as well,
yeah,
where I wasn't actually down.
But you're operating and watching. And
right.
Chris, this winter, presented a really fascinating talk during the Port Townsend Marine Science Center lecture series, Future of the Oceans, all about glass sponges, which is a special of interest of yours, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I find that subject beautifully fascinating. Are you still engaged in that work?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm such a science nerd, I actually have a little laboratory in my basement. It's just for dissolving sponge tissue with Clorox or something and having some alcohols preserve stuff and then microscopes and cameras to take pictures.
Wow.
But I'm still doing it. I've got some other interests that are more local type of interest too.
Well, and I didn't mention it, but Chris, you are a Port Townsend resident now, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, before we get further into the subject, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So would you like a hint to that? Well, part of the hint is scientists have called this a bio-twang. I think of banjos and metal music. And yes, it is related to the topic today. I will tell you what it's not. It's not the sort of eerie communications of, a highly secret submarine warship fleet. And it's not the warning call of some huge, scary monster of the deep. But it is of the deep, and we'll listen again at the later part of the show and reveal what it is. Thinking about the deep sea, dark, mysterious, mostly unexplored, and I think there's been a surge of knowledge in the last few decades because the technology has allowed us to do that. Would you say that's probably true?
I would absolutely say that's true.
And I got a number from somewhere on the web with NOAA general comments saying that over 80% of the oceans remain unexplored. I mean, that's a lot of territory.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, particularly when you think, it's something over 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by the oceans. The oceans have, 97-98% of the water. So you've got depth and area, it's amazing. And I know, when you see, every now and again, you'll see a photograph appear in the news, and my jaw will drop almost always, because it's always some sort of weird new creature. There was an isopod in the last couple of years that made it to the New York Times. Isopod is, of course, a pill bug or a potato bug, one of these roly-poly things. And this isopod, now I think they called it the Darth Vader isopod because it was kind of the size of a football. And it looked like it was, it seriously meant business. But it's like, whoa, what is that? And there's all sorts of other things down there. But in talking to Chris as we sort of getting ready for this conversation, I realized how those photo images, in a way, can be really misleading because we can form really sort of superficial and incorrect assumptions or perceptions. I was thinking about why are all the creatures in the deep sea supersized? Until Chris pointed out to me, well, not really. You know? They have the same size range and variability as terrestrial. I went, oh, yeah. But it's because of the what you see sort of in the general media. It sort of leads you to that incorrect assumption.
Yeah, the tiny little crustaceans usually don't make the front page.
Right. They don't on land either, yeah. So let's think about the deep sea for a minute in terms of the sort of physical characteristics and why it's different than the ocean's shallower depths. Of course, the first thing is light. Anybody who dives or has gone into the ocean water know that you lose light pretty fast. And by the time you're down at the deep sea, there is essentially no sunlight left.
Sort of the specific depth range is usually in clear water that you find in tropical seas. Mm-hmm. Most light is extinguished at around 400 meters or a little over 1,000 feet down. But light doesn't all just sort of gradually go down uniformly. You have different frequencies of light that go out with the reds and yellows going first and then your blues in that range and are kind of the last to go.
And, oh, actually, I've been using the word deep sea, and I haven't really asked you. When you talk about deep sea, how do you define that?
I'm biased. I guess I'm a deep sea snob.
So. Okay.
I would typically think that 400 meters where you lose pretty much all light is kind of an upper depth of what I would consider sort of deep sea. And then going all the way down to the trenches, of course, which can be 9,000 meters down. But most of the seafloor is 5,000 meters down. But also, quite often, I think deep sea is over maybe 1,000 meters down because that's when you start to get pretty strange stuff showing up.
And I think I also read something as I was browsing around the internet that, and I'm going to leave the scientific measurement world for a minute because this is what I remember, that the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest, is something, 7 or 8 miles deep.
Something like that.
Something like that, right. And Mount Everest, is only something like 5 or 5.5 miles high. So it really went, that's a way to think about it as, that's really quite deep. But you said the average depth of the ocean is?
5,000 meters, 4,000 to 5,000 meters. That's kind of standard.
So thinking about the light again, there's no ambient or sunlight, but there is some light, and I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. And the other thing that sort of made me pause in thinking about that is with no light, that means no phytoplankton, no plants, and it must be a completely different food web structure.
Yes.
Than up there where there is light and the world we're used to. So talk to us a bit about the adaptations to the darkness and bioluminescence.
Well, just about the food web before I get into that.
Okay.
So a lot of the food is coming from surface waters. It's just falling down. It's organic debris, organic material that's coming down. Also, some animals can die and drop to the seafloor. And so a fair number of deep sea animals, some of the fishes are scavengers. So this is a food source in general for them. But then there's a lot of small crustaceans and things like that that are in the water that filtering animals such as corals and sponges can eat, as well as all this organic material that's around.
So that gives you some predator-prey possibilities then.
Right. But for the adaptations for darkness, for example, well, most of the predation, I would say, is not really vision-based like it is in shallower water. There may be some, you know, there are some large deep water fishes that have very large eyes that can detect very minute amounts of light that maybe can do a little bit of visual predation. But I think most of the predation you get down there is olfaction, smell. Mm-hmm. They have ways of detecting vibrations.
Changes in pressure on
changes in pressures or movements or something like that, that they know something's close by. Another possibility is electric fields. So,
talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so basically olfaction, vibrations, and electric fields. I don't know much about it, but basically I think living organisms to a certain extent can create very minute electric fields mm-hmm. that can be detected. And some animals more than other animals as well. And or a disturbance that's picked up as sort of an electrical change.
And I think I sort of vaguely remember reading about some freshwater creatures that have some abilities in that world. So I imagine it's powerful to have the pressure sensitive and the electrical field sensitive skills down there.
It lets you know when something's close that you might be able to nab, because there's a lot of ambushing going on down there. For example, there are fish that have bioluminescent lures.
Right.
And they're just sitting on the bottom and they're wiggling their little lure that's lighting up. And here comes this crustacean. Oh boy, this looks good. And goes down there to grab whatever it thinks it is. And the next thing you know, it's in the fish's mouth. You know, there's other animals that actually live in holes and they're kind of hidden. And then they feel an animal passing over their hole and they just come shooting up and bam, they hit the animal and get it that way. So a lot of ambushing going on, luring.
So you mentioned the sort of bioluminescence lure fish, which I think pictures of those are sort of have been in the literature for a long time. Those were some of the fish that were dredged up sort of years ago and early. Tell us a bit about just what is bioluminescence? And
it's light being produced by an organism through a chemical reaction. And basically, there's a fair number of deep water animals that can do this. And it isn't just fish, too. There's some corals that can bioluminesce. And, of course, a lot of plankton.
A lot of plankton can, you know, even in shallow water. Yeah.
In some cases, the function of doing that is pretty obvious. You know, when you've got it on the end of a lure, I get that.
Yeah.
There was a story many years ago about these fish that are midwater fish called mctophids or lantern fish. And they had these bioluminescent organs, photophores, all along their ventral surface of their stomachs, basically. And people finally got what that was all about. And it's called a phenomenon called countershading. So they're not in the deep, deep ocean. There is still some ambient light above them. And what they're doing is they're using bioluminescence to match the downwelling ambient light. So they basically disappear.
And you see that pattern in some whales and dolphins and other creatures as well. So if you're looking up, you're not going to see an outline of a dark creature. You just see the lighter.
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of these predators would attack from below to get the animals.
Back when you were talking about sort of stuff coming down from above, it occurs to me that, sure, you're going to have, I would expect, sort of a steady downward flow of miscellaneous organic stuff. But when you mentioned when, you know, a larger creature dies and ends up on the bottom, that's a source of food. But I would think that would be pretty spotty.
It is spotty. But what's interesting is that most of the time we are totally unaware that whales have a lifetime and whales die all the time. And a lot of them wind up on the deep seafloor. Yeah. And when they do wind up down there, it is, you know, everybody on deck because there is a huge banquet to be had. And you got all types of crabs and brittle stars and everything just descending on this whale. And they'll be on it for months eating on this thing.
You know, that reminds me, I shouldn't do this, but go back into old stories. I think it must have been in the early 70s. I was grad school at UW and saw a film, and it was in black and white. It was very coarse as a film goes, but it showed wire crate with various fish heads and stuff that had been lowered to the deep ocean, don't remember how deep, and then a camera that went on a timer. So it was pretty basic technology at that point. But I got so fascinated by, you could see the first round of the creepy crawlies, the sort of the worms, the little isopods and the crabs, and then eventually these slimy eely fish things that would come in and almost tie themselves in knots, and all you'd see was this thing of whirling eel things. And then the very last photograph on this film, and I'm sure it probably was a classic from its time, is something comes in and all you can see is the skin of this something, and it takes over the whole photographic field. And then, that's sort of the end of the film. But it was like, but that took a long time, when you actually kind of look into it and to get the signals out across the ocean to finally the large guy came. He got it,
But, probably most of those animals pick that up from olfaction, from the whale decomposing. Mm-hmm. So that's just a really major way in which predators or scavengers find their food.
Okay, while we're thinking about the unimportance, in a way, of sight relative to finding food, what about finding mates?
Kind of the same thing. Olfaction is probably playing a major role, simply because a lot of animals will release pheromones. So, for example, in...
Yeah, much like the terrestrial world.
Right, and much like the terrestrial world, where fish often mm-hmm. will, when female fish are very close to ovulating, for example, they'll release types of chemicals called prostaglandins, and the prostaglandins will go into the water as they're ovulating. And males are, of certain species of fish, they're actually able to detect the prostaglandins, and they know that the female is ready to spawn. So if you sort of extrapolate that to a lot of other animals, whether it's prostaglandins or some other type of compound, they can find their mates just probably through chemical sense.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds relatively straightforward in a way then.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's all types of weird reproduction things that are going on. The parasitic male attaching to the large female.
That's another sort of classic picture I remember. Yeah.
Right. And then
would you describe that for listeners who haven't seen it?
The female's normal size, kind of a, and I'm trying to remember exactly what fish it is, but I've forgotten. Anyway, fairly normal sized fish, and then the male is this tiny little thing that attaches to the female right around her vent, and all his entire purpose in life was to service her and to fertilize her eggs.
It's kind of like you think of it as sort of like a parasite, like a barnacle on a whale or something.
I think they even call it something like that, a parasitic reproductive mode or something. But corals, there's a fair number of corals that actually it's too hard for them to produce release eggs and then hope that all their eggs get fertilized, because they may be sparse enough in density. So they can actually produce both eggs and sperm and essentially self-fertilize. And then they can release competent larvae already that are ready to settle immediately by themselves.
From the pictures you see, most of the animals are white, gray, kind of not much color, and if it is, it's in the gray world.
Yeah.
Occasionally, you'll see a picture of something, I've seen a picture of fish, that has a red coloration. Now, we know nobody's going to see that down there, and a creature's not going to want to put a whole lot of energy into something that isn't of some kind of adaptive value. What's going on when you see color in an animal that's that deep?
Well, I think sometimes it's just the nature of the molecules that are making up the animal's body. So, again, you're in an environment where there isn't any light. There is no reflection of this color. There's the color is not being expressed in their natural environment until we go down there and artificially illuminate it. right? So then attributing a visual function to that color, well, it's hard to do. But just assuming that, you know, there's all types of different molecules and they would express artificial light or reflect artificial light in different ways.
Because that's the way they're built.
That's just the way they're built.
So it isn't an adaptive feature or an evolutionary feature. It's just...
One possible reason is that if they consume a bioluminescent prey and the prey is in their stomach, then they might want to conceal that animal that might still be bioluminescing by putting a pigment around its intestine and its stomach or its skin that would block that bioluminescence, because the prey might actually light them up for their predators.
Yeah.
And they don't want that.
No, not a good thing. Let's move on to temperature, to running to the physical characteristics of the deep sea. We know, of course, sunlight can warm the upper layers, never very warm for those of us who live in coastal areas. But by the time you get that deep, the temperature gets around to almost freezing. What does that mean for life down there in terms of their metabolism, growth rates? How do critters cope with that kind of temperature?
They do quite well, actually, with that kind of temperature. We don't, because we're not used to it.
Well, but, and we're warm-blooded mammals,
Right. But typically, growth rates in the deep sea are pretty slow, as you can imagine. Metabolic rates are pretty slow. That also means that a lot of deep sea animals, sometimes they have to go a long time between meals, right? And if they have a very slow metabolism, it's not a real problem for them. They can go quite a long time. And then until they get to their next meal.
That actually would be an advantage if you're relying on stuff that comes
right
down from above.
From above. Yeah. And then it's also, it probably allows them to live very extended lives. Now, we don't know how long deep sea animals live, except in a few cases. One of them is corals, like the black coral tree in a particular genus called Anapathes. And the Anapatharians, that family as well. There's been some work that's been done to age individual colonies, because they actually produce sort of a hard substance, almost like tree rings.
Like the deposits on the
right
the coral
hard
parts.
And there's a group that's from, I'm trying to remember where they were. They were looking at this and they found some black coral trees were 4,000 years old. And they suspected that there was at least one colony that they had encountered. And this was at around 400 meters deep, 500 meters deep, so not ultra deep. But anyway, they suspected that there was one colony that was probably quite a bit older than that.
Wow.
And then there's been some speculation about some of the glass sponges down there. There was one in the Antarctic where the water is even colder in general, very close to freezing. That they estimated, based on a couple visits 10 years apart, that sponge could be potentially even 15,000 years old or something like that. They detected zero difference in size over the course of 10 years or changes. So you can live very long. You're a little slow, but you can live for a real long time if you live in the deep sea.
Thank you, Chris.
You are very, very welcome. It was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it.
Me too. To listeners, I urge you to come back for part 2 and 3 to be aired within the next couple of months. We'll talk more about the other physical factors that influence life in the deep sea, such as water pressures that can be 1,000 times that of here on the surface of the Earth. To translate that into something possibly more understanding, but possibly also just plain silly, 1,000 times pressure is about equivalent to 100 adult elephants standing on your head. I can't imagine that either. And as far as temperature goes, it gets to almost freezing down there. We'll also talk more about not only the really strange animals that live at these extreme depths, but also about what scientists know about how deep sea ecosystems work. So before we leave the deep ocean. Let's go back to that mystery sound. It's called the Western Pacific Bio Twang. And, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. It was low, it's sonorous, and then it's sort of squeaky and mechanical and weird. It was first detected in 2014 by some underwater hydrophones near the Mariana Trench, and it was completely unclear what it was. Scientists were sort of scratching their head, you know, was it something related to a geological sound? Or, you know, you get lots of sounds that are related to icebergs on the bottom. And the sounds, of course, travel huge distances. Or was it a critter? And some of the initial theories thought that, well, maybe it was the baleen whales. And they sort of looked at the frequency recordings, and that's what led them that direction. But when they looked at the behavior of the baleen whales in the area, and the presence of the sound correlated to nothing. Eventually, somewhere in the 2020s, scientists noticed that the occurrence of the sound was occurring when there were birds' whales. Now, I have never seen a bird's whale. But apparently they're relatively common in the deeper oceans, in particularly the western part of the Pacific. And they actually relied on, this is the thing that got my attention, they relied on AI to process loads of data to narrow down what this could possibly be. So the current theory is it's the North Pacific population of birds' whales who make the bio twang. More weird stuff. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Nature Now. Hope you've enjoyed the program. If you want to listen to it again, or if you have missed past programs, do check out either the KPTZ website under podcasts, or you can listen to it on your favorite podcast app. And we also have an Instagram site, so wander around the internet and see where you can find us. Our sound engineer today, of course, is the wonderful Nora Petrich. And I will thank Noah for that amazing bio-twang sound. And I want to thank everyone for listening. Our ending music is composed by Rick Bauer.